and welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I'm your host. In September 2022, the Labour and Employment Relations Court declared the NSSF Act 2013 unconstitutional because it was enacted without public participation and the involvement of the Senate. This month, a three-judge bench in the Court of Appeal has overturned that decision. In fact, the Court of Appeal, in their judgment, stated that the Employment and Labour Relations Court made a mistake in declaring the NSSF Act unconstitutional. On today's episode, we'd like to unpack the NSSF Act 2013 and the contentions around it. To discuss this topic, in studio with me is Deborah Kibagendi. Deborah is the legal officer at Octagon Africa. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you so much, Jen, and thank you for having us.
Okay. And she's joined by her colleague, Winnie Nasirumbi. Winnie is the assistant legal officer at Octagon Africa. Welcome, Winnie.
Hi, Jen. Thank you for having us.
Okay. Before we begin this episode, could you tell us about Octagon Africa, who you are and what you do?
So Octagon Africa is a leading financial services provider. We deal in pension administration, rather, insurance brokerage, training services, as well as actuarial services. We are based in three countries, Kenya, Uganda, and Zambia.
Now, to kick off the substance of our discussion, Deborah, could you give us an overview of the NSSF Act 2013?
Okay. So first of all, I'll start by making reference to the Constitution, just to let our listeners know that we have a constitutional right to social security. The Constitution under Article 43.1 provides 1E rather, that Kenyans have a right to social security and also gives the government the mandate to actually formulate measures to ensure that the citizenry have social security. And in that background, that's how we came about, or at least the government came about with the NSSF Act, which was... There had been an NSSF Act, but then it was repealed with a new NSSF Act, which was passed in 2013, with commencement scheduled for January 2014. So ideally, the fund is just meant to provide social security to the citizenry so that Kenyans are able to save for their future, to invest in their future so that once they retire, they're able to accommodate their lifestyle in retirement. So from the Act, the major overview from the Act would be the increase of the contributions, considering the previous Act had members paying a limit of 200 shillings. Now with the new Act, we're able, the contributions have been increased to actually have a member contribute 6% of their pensionable earnings, and the employer also matching the same. And also a mandatory registration for employers and also the employees. So for any employer who has even one employee, they are now mandated to actually register with the NSSF fund.
So by any employer, you mean like me and my nanny?
Yes.
I am now an employer I am mandatorily required to actually register NSSF,
yes.
And I'm meant to submit a total of 12%, 6% from me.
Exactly.
And that must be remitted monthly.
Monthly.
Now, I can imagine that that brought about a lot of challenges. Not everyone wanted to increase the percentage that they give, one.
Yes.
And two, not everyone wanted to be mandatorily registered.
Okay.
So can you tell us a little bit, Winnie, about the decision by the Employment and Labour Relations Court on the enforceability and constitutionality of that act?
I'll divide the question into three. Probably deal with it into three parts. I'll briefly touch on the petitioner's case and the respondent's case and briefly talk about the court's decision, what the court decided on the matter. To start with, we can refer back to September 19th of 2022, where the three-judge bench of the Employment and Labour Relations Court, the court declared that the act was invalid on the basis that it was not tabled before the Senate prior to its enactment. The petitioners in that case, that is the Kenya Tea Growers Association, they had sued the NSSF Board of Trustees. on grounds that the Act, the 2013 Act, on its entirety, was in violation of the Constitution of Kenya. And therefore, they were seeking to have the Act being declared null and void. According to the petitioners, they aver that members have always had a long-standing and adequate gratuity, pension, and security schemes, which are far more advantageous to the employees than that which NSSF was providing in the Act. Therefore, compelling such employees to register with NSSF punitively, it was overburdening the already strained payslips of the employees. That was the petitioner's case. And when we talk a little bit on the respondent's case, they were arguing that their role to provide social security was not for the member of the NSSF fund, but it was for the state as stipulated in Article 43 of the Constitution. And we can also see some conceding. The RBA was conceding that there are no constitutional justifications for denying employees and employers their choice of pension scheme. Initially, a member would choose either to be in a provident scheme or a pension scheme. But for this, the new NSSF Act 2013, it mandates that the member will be in a pension scheme with an exclusion of the members, the voluntary members who are making voluntary contributions. So this is also something that RBA, even though they are respondent, they conceded to in relation to the petitioner's case. However, RBA, they also noted that the NSSF scheme was exclusively meant for the employee alone. But you see, you do realize that with the new NSSF 2013 Act, it accommodates everyone. It accommodates employees on permanent and pensionable, employees on contract of service, those under wages, actually informal sector. It accommodates everyone in it. So RBA were of the opinion that this, when it comes to National Security Social Fund, it was supposed to be set aside only for employees and not everyone as the new act. So lastly, I'll just touch on the court's decision. The court decided to set aside the respondent's case, and as a result, the case was dismissed on grounds that it lacked public participation, and there was also no involvement during the drafting of the legislation. They did not involve the Senate, which by far was considered to be of vital importance when it comes to this NSSF 2013 Act.
Now, Deborah, could you tell us about now what happened afterwards? Of course, as they are wont to do, the NSSF board appealed that decision and went to the Court of Appeal. And this year in February, the beginning of this month, a decision was rendered by the Court of Appeal that had an impact on the enforceability of the NSSF Act 2013.
The Court of Appeal this year was able to set aside the judgment that had been passed by the ELRC court. And the reasons that were given based on the decision was that the ELRC court is mandated to only deal with constitutional matters that are dealing with the employer-employer relationship. And so they saw the issue of determining whether the NSSF Act is actually a properly constituted act was beyond the court's jurisdiction. So it was thrown out based on that, and also that the Senate needed not to be involved. You can remember from what Winnie has mentioned, one of the reasons why the act had been declared unconstitutional was because it lacked a collaboration of sorts between the parliament and the Senate so that to enact that law, because it also touched on county governments. So on that basis, the Court of Appeal ruled that it needed not be taken to Senate because there was no backing to actually show that there needed to be collaboration between the two houses for that act to actually be enacted. So the essence of that is now the NSSF Act of 2013 became legal by the Court of Appeal setting aside the judgment. So in their ruling, they allowed the appeal. And now the NSSF Act of number 45 of 2013 is now a legal act with immediate enforcement.
Now, what does that mean for us? How much contribution, what is the change in contribution from what was previously there to now what will be enforced under this new act?
Okay. So with this new act, of course, it comes with its changes. So first, you will appreciate that in the previous regime, what we had was only a provident fund, so that once a member retires, you're given your monies as a lump sum. But now the act provides for two funds, a pension fund and a provident fund. So now we remit monthly, and then once you retire, you get monthly payments rather than a one-off lump sum payment. And then the provident fund, which will cater basically to self-employed individuals who wish to contribute for their social security to be accessible at retirement. Also, what it means that we've increased our contribution so that the employer now is required to pay 6%, and also the employee is required to match that. Or rather, the employee is required to pay 6% from their pensionable earnings, and the employer will match the same. So dependent on the act, it talks about lower earnings limit and upper earnings limit. There's a cap on 6,000 for the lower earnings limit. We'll have a specific tabulation for them, and also for people who are earning above 18,000. So basically, the general thing we should be able to appreciate is now the contributions are coming from the 200 that we were paying previously in the previous regime to now to increased amount.
So it's an exponential increase. You know, you go from 200 to 6,000.
Yes, yeah. To around 2,000 in the first year, and also appreciate that it's a progressive
increase.
So that by the time we're getting 5 years after the implementation of the act, the rates will be totally different from what you're paying now. Yeah.
Well, and I agree. I understand why the government would want to do an incremental progressive increase. Like, you don't want to take people from a very minimal, very tokenist amount of 200 shillings, even just 2,000.
Yeah.
That's really a very big increase. You want to take them gradually. And I think that that was the essence of why the act was challenged to begin with. It felt very, very punitive. It felt very, very harmful. And I think there was also some education that was required. The public needed to understand that previously under CAP 258, the NSSF Act CAP 258, we only had one fund, the Provident Fund. And that now we have two funds. We still have a Provident Fund, but we now also have a pension fund. And that now, instead of having, as we previously had, a lump sum payment that you got, that if I remember from media, I think the president gave a media briefing where he was speaking against the act and saying that you get about 70K. What is 70K?
Which doesn't even make
going
sense.
To do having for worked, you? Having worked all your life, getting only 70,000 shillings as a lump sum, a one-off payment, it really had no impact. It was a drop in the ocean.
Sure.
But we also need to understand that people have recency bias, and they will not understand that over time is when you will see the benefit of having contributed that significant amount for the entire period of your working life. Then you'll be able to get a pension fund that gives you money monthly as opposed to just that one lump sum payment.
Yeah,
now, correct. A couple of questions that then come up. One, with the implementation of the act, we can definitely anticipate some challenges. What are the probable challenges that the implementation of the act will face?
The first challenge would be, like you mentioned, on education. I feel like the members of the public, really, not everyone is literate enough to actually understand the effect of those rates. So for the option of the Provident Fund, where we have voluntary contributions from members, still to just also take advantage of the social security that we expect all citizenry to actually invest in. Members of the public need to be educated on the reasons why it is very important to save for their future. Secondly, another challenge would be there's increase in contribution, but also not, there's nowhere they've talked of increase in pensionable earnings. So that it would be right the way the petitioners in the ELRC court were saying, it will be sort of burdensome. And especially if there's no increase in your earnings, but then the increased contribution, because then it eats into your net pay or you pay rather.
Okay. So there definitely will be some challenges in implementation. Deborah, could you tell us a little bit about the probable challenges that would be there in the implementation of the NSSF Act?
First, I would start with the checking and balancing. The NSSF, it makes reference to the authority, and you'll appreciate the authority being the Retirement Benefits Authority, is able to manage or supervise pension schemes. But there's no mention of that in the NSSF Act. So we're not sure if the Retirement Benefits Authority will be able to also sort of supervise this large scheme, because it will be large, of course, because every Kenya would be expected to actually make contribution to it. So it is bound to actually grow into a large fund. So yeah, that would bring a bit of challenges in terms of trusting and accountability just in the fund and its management. Also, the investment, how will we know what sort of asset classes this fund will be making investments in to actually guarantee Kenyans better returns? Because at the end of the day, once you retire, you want to receive a considerable amount. And over time, you'd expect the investments to be done in a way that grows the fund rather than mull it with losses of investing in asset classes which are not really beneficial to the fund. Another challenge would be the voluntary contributions bit. Given that the citizenry would be expected or are expected to invest in their social security, will there be member education or some sort of civic education rather, to educate the public on the importance of actually investing in their future? And also another challenge that I can foresee would be there's no increase in people's salaries the way the petitioners under the ELRC decision had postulated, that we needed to have, there is an increase in contributions, but then there's no increase in your salary. So in some way, it could be burdensome to members.
Thank you for that. I also have another question, and this is, I don't know whether it'll be a challenge in implementation. We will see that as time goes by. However, the previous payments that we remitted under NSSF were really negligible. This led to many people joining and being members of other pension schemes. And now that you're already a member of a different pension scheme to which you have been contributing to for X number of years, dependent on how when you joined that scheme, are you still required to contribute to NSSF if you're a member of another pension scheme?
Yes, Jen, we will be required to also contribute to the state scheme, because the state scheme, it's mandatory to contribute. So there will be a portion which will be going into the state scheme, and also part of it retained in your private scheme. Now, the provision that the NSSF Act has brought into place is the contracting out. So a scheme can actually apply to RBA to be allowed to contract out, so that part of the contributions that are remitted into the NSSF fund, which would comprise tier two contributions, once you receive that contracting out from RBA after meeting the requirements that they need as under the act for the scheme to be a contracted out scheme, then you will be allowed to remit the contributions into the private scheme. So that the tier one, it's been classified into tier one, tier two. So tier one is mandatorily expected to go to the NSSF fund, while tier two, you will have the option of remitting it into your private pension plan. So a member can be able to remit in NSSF and also just remit into the private scheme.
So let me try and explain this back to you and see if I understood what you're saying.
Okay.
There is a classification of tiers of contributions to NSSF.
Yes.
Tier one schemes go directly into NSSF, the state managed fund.
Yes.
However, through the Retirement Benefits Authority, and I'll come back to Retirement Benefits Authority in a moment, you can, any private scheme can apply for contracting out into their scheme.
Yes.
That would mean, and I feel like this was a way in which to ensure that people did not exit their private scheme, since they were going to have to mandatorily give to the state scheme, and that would a mass exodus of people into the state scheme.
Right.
You can apply as a private scheme to be an option where persons can contract out their funds and just remit to the private scheme as they have been in the past.
Yes.
So then that gives the onus on private schemes to work with the Retirement Benefits Authority.
To work with the Retirement Benefits Authority, and also would, of course, have to seek some sort of approval from NSSF, because currently, you see, it also has timelines before you contract out. So the funds which will have been remitted into the NSSF fund will then have to be applied for the transfer of those funds into the contracted out scheme.
So there is some sort of interim period in which everyone will be remitting directly to NSSF,
whether
or not you're in a private scheme or not.
Or not.
So there might be a situation of double payments or underpayment to your private scheme. And at some point, there'll need to be some sort of balancing that happens where any money that has been remitted there into a scheme that has been approved for contracting out gets transferred from the state fund to the private scheme.
Correct.
Now, what exactly is the role of the Retirement Benefits Authority with regard to the NSSF Act?
Okay, from the NSSF Act, from what we've been able to see, you'd realize the NSSF Act also makes reference to the Retirement Benefits Act, where it says the provisions which have been provided by the Act will also be an addition to what is provided by the RBA Act. So the authority, for instance, is in charge of issuing this contracted out scheme with a certificate to allow the contributions from Tier 2 to actually come into the scheme. They are also mandated, in the instance there's a member who has maybe an issue or an appeal to make, the same can be done to the tribunal. And the tribunal, which has been as defined by the Act, the NSSF Act, makes reference to the Retirement Benefits Appeal Tribunal. So in a way, the RBA, though not expressly pointed out in the Act to be the overseer of the NSSF fund, rather, sort of would have some supervisory role insofar as the management, for instance, the investment, because even the investment, they make a reference to them being done as per the RBA guidelines. So in a way, you see, there'll be some sort of interconnection of sorts, so that the RBA is able to actually also just oversee or supervise how this NSSF is being managed. Also appreciating that NSSF is managed by a board of trustees in its own way. So I'd like to see how that one goes.
Yeah, and that definitely will be the question of the day, how the implementation of the Act will happen, bearing in mind the different new dynamics that are at play here.
Yeah.
The existing pension schemes that employers and employees have formed and have been contributing to in the past, the increase and the mandatory requirement for them to remit 6% each into the state fund, and also just the option of contracting out and seeing how that will play out and how the money will then be used and whether the state will be able to use it for its intended purpose, borrowing to be able to run state projects. Now, I'd like to bring us to the end of this episode and to the last question that we have today. And my question is to you, Winnie, to end our episode today. Is this the end of litigation? Is there a likelihood that the Court of Appeal decision will be challenged in the Supreme Court? And if so, why do you think that would happen?
That might be a difficult one, considering that the appeal period for court appeal cases to the Supreme Court, it's capped at 14 days. We await to see any move by the either party to see whether they will appeal against the decision made by the Court of Appeal. But either way, the decision by the Court of Appeal may not be final per se. We cannot rule out that this is the final decision until it's over. What we can wait for the 14-day period, wait to see whether we'll have any appeal to the Supreme Court, to the Apex Court. Probably from there, we'll be well informed on whether it will be the end of litigation or not. But should the matter settle at the Court of Appeal, the NSSF board would have achieved its goal. Should it settle at the Court of Appeal, the NSSF board would have achieved its goal of creating a larger retirement pool for the employees upon their retirement.
On to our next segment, the Book of the Week. And our Book of the Week this week is titled Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. The authors of the book are Brian Christian and Tom Griffith. And in this book, the authors show us how algorithms have much more to do with our day-to-day lives than we may think. They also give us practical examples of how we can use algorithms to solve problems and make decisions. The choice of this book is influenced by the fact that we celebrated Valentine's Day this week, and I want to share with you the first algorithm the authors talk about in the book. It answers an age-old problem. How do you know when to stop dating and settle down? It's called the optimal stopping problem. And the answer is called the 37% rule. So what do? You gather data until you reach 37%, then you make a decision as soon as you find an option that's better than what you saw in the first 37%. The 37% rule, can be applied to people or to the amount of time. First, let me apply it to looking for a house. So you spend 37% of your time looking in your house hunt, looking at the options available without committing to anything. But after that point, be prepared to pay for and move into the very first place you see that is better than anything you've seen so far. So how does this work if you're looking for a husband or a wife? So let's say, for argument's sake, that the time frame you have to find a partner is between the ages of 18 and 40. According to the 37% rule, 26 years is the optimal point to switch from looking to leaping. So if you're 26 years old, the next person you see that's better than anyone you've dated, marry them. But there are some challenges here. The best spouse for you might have been in the 37% you dismissed, and the person you eventually commit to might reject you. But mathematically speaking, this algorithm works most of the time, especially if you're looking to rent a house and you have limited time. That brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guests, Deborah Kibagendi and Winnie Nasirumbi. Thank you, Deborah and Winnie.
Thank you so much, Jen, for having
thank
us.
You
looking
so
forward
much, Jen.
To engaging again.
Thank you. Yes. And I'm your host, June Kambuni. Thank you so much for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Tell us what you think about it in the comment section of our social media pages or on email. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Bad Gamma Advocates on social media. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast. Let's get free.